Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
We're so glad you can join us. Today we've got a great episode bringing together two guests. We're joined by Tori Tosig and Max Bergman. And before I introduce them, I'll just say kind of how we came to put this podcast together a couple of months ago, and we've been wanting to do this episode for some time. A couple of months ago, Tori and Max were co-authors joined by several other transatlanticists who wrote an article laying out a progressive view for the transatlantic relationship. And so we thought we'd come together here and have a discussion about what that might look like. And so just by way of brief introduction, Tori is currently the research director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. She's also a non-resident fellow in the Foreign Policy Program's Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. And Max is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on European security and U.S.-Russia policy. From 2011 to 2017, he was in the Department of State in a number of different positions, including on the policy planning staff and as a speechwriter to then Secretary of State John Kerry. So welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Jim, I think a perfect place to start is Jim was just doing a little dramatic reading before we began recording the episode, and I thought that could be a great place for the beginning of our conversation.
In fact, it wasn't even dramatic reading as much as it was a very sad reading, because I guess the president is giving some remarks before the National Governors Conference, and he was talking about the European Union and NATO to the governors. Which is great. I'm glad that they're learning about the EU and NATO. I mean, certainly, you know, as they do their governor's work, they don't necessarily talk about the EU or NATO. But the quotes that have just popped up, number one, he said that the European Union was really formed so they could treat us badly. And then the second point about NATO was that it was going down like a rocket ship before he took office. So we could spend the next hour talking about that, but the experts that we have with us might want to comment about the European Union and maybe set the record straight. Were they really formed so that they could treat us badly?
Well, maybe I'll start. I think this hits at sort of a real misconception about the European Union that has kind of permeated through not just sort of conservative circles, but in general sort of strategic Washington and the view that the EU is kind of built as sort of this economic block to hit the United States. And if we go back to the early post-World War II period, and the United States had to go about reconstructing and rebuilding Europe, it was the U.S. that actually went about furthering European integration through the Marshall Plan initially to break down barriers. And it was, you know, John Foster Dulles, the great Cold Warrior in the early 1950s, went to a NATO council meeting and essentially banged his shoe on the chair type moment to push Europe to create the European Defense Community, which was effectively a European army. We wanted Europe to unite. The coal and steel community was something we strongly supported. Eisenhower saw that the United States of Europe was one of his main goals and objectives. We tried to create Europe in our own image. Because we didn't want to do it again. We didn't want to go back and do World War III. And to do that, we felt Europe needed to overcome its national differences. So I think what Trump is sort of highlighting there is a broader ignorance of kind of America's support for European integration and America's support also for the European Union when it was put in place in the early 90s.
Tori, maybe just to set aside for a moment some of the current tensions in the relationship. So I think we've all talked a lot about the tension that things like the JCPOA have created, the Paris Climate Agreement, the trade tensions. But if we set those aside for a moment, as you look forward, what do you see as the key challenges that the United States and Europe will face in the coming decade?
Well, it's a great question. I think to take a step back for a moment and just address a little bit of what Max said. And Max is exactly right. The United States has a long history of investing in European integration and investing in a Europe that is whole, free, and at peace and prosperous. And before we even got to the Trump administration, I think there was a lamentable shift away from Europe within U.S. foreign policy. We, of course, had September 11th and then the launching of the global war on terror, Years later, the global financial crisis, the Obama administration's pivot to Asia, there's a long list of priorities within U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy that have moved America's attention away from Europe and away from our partnership and alliance with some of America's oldest allies and partners that share common goals and values. And so Trump represents a crisis within the transatlantic relationship, but unfortunately, this is a relationship that has fallen into disrepair for many reasons beyond just this present moment. And to tee up our conversation going forward, there is a significant amount of changing power dynamics and economic and social dynamics that the U.S. and Europe need to be addressing together. But first, we have to overcome this present moment of distrust.
Max, maybe just to turn it over to you, kind of if you had to put together, I don't know, a top 10 list or a top 5 list, what would be high on your list in terms of what you're concerned about that the U.S. and Europe are going to have to navigate moving forward?
Right. It's a great question. And I think there's sort of two parts to it. I would say, one, the list is incredibly long. It's almost every single global issue. And I think, you know, when we think about all those global issues, whether it's climate change, whether it's arms control, or whether it's China's rise or dealing with Russia, they almost all involve working very closely with the European Union, not simply with European states, because when Europe operates as a bloc economically, it's incredibly impactful. And we saw this with Iran sanctions. It wasn't simply the U.S. putting sanctions on Iran. It was that we could do it together with the Europeans, with the EU. And the same thing applies on Russia. So when we think about how we are going to tackle any issue, tech regulation going forward, I think climate would be a high priority. In Russia and China, we need to engage with Brussels and need to engage with them with an effort to kind of develop common approaches. That's where we've been incredibly effective, I think, during the Obama administration. When we sort of moved away from that or ignored the EU, I think we became less effective. And just the last point, I think as we're increasingly in an era of global competition, as sort of is the consensus view, I think, amongst foreign policy professionals with the rise of China, resurgence of Russia, you know, our views internationally are going to be contested more, and we're going to need powerful allies and partners. And the EU is an incredibly powerful ally and partner, and is viewed that way by much of the world. So that, I think there's so much that we need to do in this relationship, and we need to get beyond this sort of ideological opposition to the EU, which I think permeates a lot of our thinking.
So there's a lot there to jump into, and I want to. I know Tori just recently co-authored just yesterday an article on U.S., and how the United States needs to work together with Europe on China. And you just were hitting on this idea of putting the EU front and center of the transatlantic relationship. So I definitely want to dig into both of those. But if we just step back for 1 second, I just would love to hear from both of you your motivation for writing the piece, this progressive approach to transatlantic relations. Clearly, there's something, it's a fraught moment in transatlantic relations. So what was your motivation in doing this piece, and kind of what void maybe did you think that you were filling by putting forward these ideas?
I can jump in here. So first, I think it's important to say that this effort was led by two of our great colleagues, both based in Berlin, Tyson Barker at the Aspen Institute and Rachel Rizzo, who's currently a Bosch Fellow in Berlin.
And one of CNAS's own, we have to note.
Of course, she's
a plank owner of Brussels sprouts.
Right. And I think what we've all realized is that there is a very strong debate within U.S. foreign policy going on right now between a wide range of, if you want to call them, ideological camps. I mean, progressives, conservatives, isolationists, international liberals, and you know, especially for millennials in this conversation, progressive foreign policies present an appealing way forward. I mean, being progressive in itself is a very wide tent. I mean, in the broadest sense, we can think about it as an effort to reform and modernize U.S. foreign policy and to renovate this liberal international system, which the United States has helped to build, to adapt to changing power, economic, and social dynamics. But then when we hone in on U.S. foreign policy, what does this mean? What does it mean to be a progressive? And I think that there are, in my view, kind of three acknowledgments that progressives take into account when looking at how U.S. foreign policy has evolved over the last decade or so, or at least in the post-9/11 era. And the first is that U.S. foreign policy has become overly dependent on military instruments, force, and presence to achieve U.S. national interests, and as a result, the U.S. has become overextended in the world today. So that's one. A second is that America's international economic policies have favored certain classes over others within American society, but within advanced democracies across the transatlantic space, that have left out broad and inclusive growth. And then the third is that this project of advancing free and open societies, democratic governance, a project that was, you know, given a lot of momentum at the fall of the wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, that this democratic project has lost momentum and remains unfinished because we need to recommit to building broad and inclusive alliances and broad and inclusive growth within our own societies. And these ideas are hitting head on, I think, with new geopolitical realities, rising and resurgent authoritarian and revisionist powers, Russia and China being foremost among them, and recognizing that we have to get these pieces of our own house together, of the West together, if we're going to confront these authoritarian powers effectively. So that's just a kind of broad overview of how I see this progressive agenda being shaped and where that debate is today.
Yeah, just to build off that, I completely agree with what Tori outlined. I also think there's an element where this is progressive, but it's also just, I think, acknowledging the reality of what's happened in Europe. And I think that we, you know, I studied the European Union when I was at LSE in the early 2000s, and then I came to Washington and wanted to work on European Union issues and found that there really wasn't much you know, space in the Washington think tank community for that to occur. That just simply wasn't the focus of where Washington's attention was. It was, as Tori mentioned, on kind of post 9/11, we were fighting two wars. And I think now, as suddenly we're worried about the future of European integration, the future of the European Union with Brexit, with the rise of nationalism and populist leaders, we sort of look back in Europe and it's kind of like we sort of missed, you know, it's like it's the young relative that has now grown up. And we, you know, my, you have changed over the last 10, 15 years. And I think the EU has transformed Europe. Europe's a different place than it was 20 years ago. And I think much to the good. And so it's about acknowledging that reality, that the EU has become one of the most, or if not the most important factor in European politics writ large. And I think Brexit is in some ways a byproduct of that. It's a byproduct of the EU mattering. And so for me, it's if we want to get things done in the world, we have to then go to the places and capitals where we can, which are impactful. And I think that's recognizing that that's the EU is central.
Maybe we can just continue down this line, because I think it's one of the very interesting points that you make in the article. And Max, I know this is kind of a pillar of the new paper that you've done on, you know, laying out a vision for what U.S.-Europe relations could look like. So I feel like you hear this popping up more and more, that people will make statements like we need to put the EU at the center of the transatlantic relationship, that too much emphasis has been given to NATO. Walk us through that a little bit in terms of what would it look like if the EU is kind of the main POC for the United States? And I mean, I think one of the questions that people wonder is, you know, if it is the EU, like, then are we just setting ourselves up for kind of slow, kind of stagnant inability to get things done? Right. So how do you see that looking?
So let me first say, and I can sort of feel Jim's eyes on me, because I don't think this is an either-or competition between the EU and NATO. And I think that's the false dichotomy that we've been in. To me, NATO is central. It is the foundational pillar of the transatlantic relationship and will remain so. It is, you know, provides that military underpinning of the alliance. But I also think we need to acknowledge that things sort of transform and change. Just as, you know, the EU is part of the negotiations with Iran, with something that would be, you know, unimaginable 20 years ago, I think we need to start thinking about the EU more in terms of how we actually implement foreign policy. So actually engaging the EU, I think we have to acknowledge it's going to be frustrating. And having in government worked a lot on the U.S.-India security relationship, I sort of imagine it something like that, where, you know, at the end of 10 years, you look at it and say, well, we went from $0 in defense industrial trade to $10 billion. Lots of progress. Must have been a straight line. No, it was like two steps forward, one step back. When you're dealing and trying to build a relationship with a country or with an entity like the EU, there's going to be a lot of times where you're frustrated bureaucratically. But so to me, I think this is about, one, there's probably bold signals that need to be sent initially. We had Jens Stoltenberg come to speak in front of Congress. Maybe we should do that with either the president of the European Commission or European Council. I think it's that kind of signals, you know, president going to the parliament, European Parliament. But then I think it's about, frankly, getting to work together. Sitting down and saying, okay, you've given top-level cover. The President of the United States has directed the State Department and other agencies, many of them are domestic policy-related, to get to work and start trying to iron out differences on different areas, to start trying to develop common approaches. And then I think there's going to be times when we're like just totally not in agreement, and then there's going to be areas where maybe we're in sync on climate change suddenly. Or maybe we're in sync on China and we adopt a very similar approach on trade. But then the areas where we disagree, maybe we sort of put them to the side and say, okay, we're going to work on that later. Just like any sort of normal relationship. And I think the one quick point is we've used our influence within Europe frequently to divide the European Union, to prevent it from taking common positions, from prevent it from acting in the security arena or foreign policy arena. And I think if we used our influence to try to strengthen EU tools, the European defense tools, European foreign policy tools, I think we can help build, make Europe a stronger, more cohesive actor. And I think that should be our broader objective as well, that we should just keep in mind when we're engaging with Europe is trying not to undercut that effort to kind of build a stronger, unified Europe overall.
Tori, do you want to add anything on that?
No, I think that was very comprehensive. I agree with Max, and I would just add one point at the end of Max's comments is that it is in America's interest to have a strong, prosperous, and independent Europe, particularly at a time, this might get into our China conversation, where some of America's competitors are also trying to exploit divisions within the European Union. And this is a time where, through the steps that Max mentioned, the U.S. should be trying to enhance a unified and strengthened EU position, whether that be on trade or security and defense issues.
Yeah, I think this is Jim. I think you're absolutely right, Tori, on that. And Max, what you were saying, what I would add, just having worked in this vineyard for so many decades, frankly, I was the only EU person in the Pentagon for years. I think we're not going to really make any progress here in Washington because we have some generational issues. It's going to take the passing of a generation or two before we're going to have leadership in the halls of the Congress and in the administration that don't carry within this hubris, this U.S. hubris that came out of the Cold War. The allies were, they might have chafed under it, but they were quiet about it during those days, during the Cold War days. The U.S. called the shots. We totally ignored the EU, and we ran things at NATO. So of course, that was going to be our entry point into Europe. It was NATO because we ran things there. And then if we had to do stuff outside of NATO, it was done one-on-one between the leadership or in the Quad. And that's kind of how we ran it. It was that Quad was the condominium, if you will, and the Dutch and the Italians and others chafed under that. They wanted to be part of it, thought it was unfair. But it got us through a lot until recently. And so two things. One is a lot of this is a reflection of U.S. statecraft. I can tell you, and it's a fact because I lived it, not one U.S. administration, including the Obama administration, came in liking Europe or the EU, or even understood NATO. It just wasn't there. And the reason I tell you that is because I had to explain it. And usually you would begin an administration trying to lay all this out, and by the end of the administration, they got it. But then we started over again. And so, our statecraft, when it came to working with Europe, to working with European institutions, including NATO, were hampered by this hubris and by ignorance. Because, number two, we never took the time to understand the EU. The EU is complicated. I don't understand understand the EU. I mean, it's difficult to understand how it works. And because of that, we mock it, we dismiss it, and we thrive in ignorance. And the only way we can explain the EU to people is to say, well, it's to counterbalance us. It was built to do bad things against us. That's what Trump says. Yeah. And that's the pity of all of this. So on what you guys said, I agree. It's going to take 10 to 20 years before you can really get some people in government from your generation looking at you, Tori. You're up in Boston, but looking at you guys, it's going to take you all to do it when you get into office. The rest are who are there now, and who have been there are rather pathetic when it comes to this. Not to be unkind to anyone, but that's the truth.
Yeah, I think
Jen, can I ask you a follow up question on that?
Sure.
Just briefly, I mean, do you think that, given the fact that there has been, I mean, what one could call a seismic all-of-government shift within U.S. foreign policy to be focusing on state-based competitors, state-based challenges, Russia, China, and acknowledging, as we're seeing, I think, across the field of Democratic candidates, that if the United States is to kind of confront these challenges, that we need to do so with like-minded allies. Do you think that that argument could create space, I mean, tangibly, in the ways that you're talking about, in the shorter time frame, to take the European Union as a strategic partner more seriously?
It's certainly a great leap in the right direction. And what I'll say is, your article that you wrote with with Julie Smith, another Brussels sprouter and one of our own, you talked about China, and a number of people, when they talk about China, they talk about the necessity of us working with the EU to deal with China in Europe, or to deal with China globally, internationally. And so, absolutely, whether it is driven by dealing with something like China, which we have to do together, or climate change, and a lot of the Democratic candidates are talking about the need to work with allies, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, everybody says that. We have to work with our allies, and then when they give in, you know, it just doesn't work that way for different reasons. But what I will say, though, is, I think under a Democratic administration, pick any of the candidates out there, I think we'll have a better chance bureaucratically and then in terms of statecraft to have brought into government as secretaries of state or defense and then the lower ranks, people who are more willing to sit down and try to work through the frustrations as it can be than to be mocking and dismissive and to say, screw it, Jim, you just go talk to them. I don't want to deal with the EU.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Jim, I couldn't agree more with your comments. I think my one avenue for hope, and this is maybe both a hopeful example and a pessimistic example, is sort of thinking about the pivot to Asia that was done in the Obama administration.
The pivot. We could go an hour on the pivot. Oh, my God.
But in some ways, you know, the pivot was sort of not a real thing, but also I think had immense impact. It was a direction.
It was a psychological thing.
Yeah, it was a direction down saying that Asia matters. And suddenly you had Deputy Assistant Secretary of States that were getting on flights to Asia, you know, that wouldn't have gone before because, oh my God,
right,
that trip is really far.
Right.
And so you suddenly saw this increase in U.S. engagement. You then saw a lot of creative thinking within U.S. government
but
how you could cooperate.
At whose expense this creative
right.
thinking? At whose expense? And so it was funny. I used to catch it from the Europeans because the assumption was, well, we're leaving Europe and we're going to pivot to China. But then I talked to my Latin America colleague and she said, no, it's aimed at us in Latin America. I said, no, it's aimed at us in Europe. So I think everyone thought it was aimed at them, you know.
But when I think about that example, though, I think sort of about a new administration, I think what's hopeful, where I'm sort of more hopeful, and I think this is the article that Tori and I did together with Rachel and Tyson and others and the report that I authored, is that if we sort of set the frame now that there needs to be this pivot toward the EU in Brussels, then what hopefully would happen is a new administration comes in and says, oh, we're pivoting to the EU, that this is pivoting as in we're rebalancing our Europe policy to the EU. Now, some NATO types would sort of maybe view that really skeptically, but really what we're doing is setting a policy direction. And there's going to be bumps in the road, but my hope is that I think you're right that there's been this sort of generation that has ignored the EU, and so just developing that knowledge and understanding will be tough, take time. But I've also seen the U.S., when we can sort of shift gears from sort of to, you know, from not cooperating to cooperation, we can shift gears very rapidly. And sometimes we can overwhelm partner nations of thinking about Vietnam and security cooperation.
Think about the Balkans. I mean, to me, the Balkans was an era where there was a lot of very creative diplomacy among the nations to come up with some type of arrangement where we could deal with what was happening there. Quints and quads and this and that. It was a pretty important era to show how you can form up approaches to deal with problems. It doesn't have to be NATO or the EU. It could be other things too.
So maybe we could talk about, I mean, so you also, I mean, you identify a number of ideas, suggestions, kind of pillars of what a progressive approach to European, to the transatlantic relationship would look like. So let's just assume that there was a change of administration this fall. Maybe, and Tori, we can start with you. What would be the couple of things that you would like to see the United States do right out of the gate to try to push relations in the direction that you all have outlined?
Well, I think on day one, a new administration could take a few straightforward steps, and the ones that are mentioned often are, you know, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, which is of strategic and huge importance to Europe, also to the United States, and to the world. So that's one. Dealing with the Iran nuclear cards and what this looks like going forward is going to be an important issue for the United States to deal with on day one that we are going to have to do in concert with our European allies. So that's a second. The third, within a progressive agenda, would be focusing, I mean, I mentioned Paris, but also looking at joint initiatives that the U.S. and Europe can take on advancing progress on climate change. I think that's an instrumental part. And then in the longer term, and I think that this gets to a key tenet of what a progressive foreign policy would look like, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast already about focusing on challenges from Russia and China and great power competition. But there's another side of the coin to that, which progressive foreign policy, particularly within the transatlantic space, pays attention to. And that's democratic backsliding within our own societies and looking at how we need to get our own house in order to deal with what are, you know, straightforwardly authoritarian challenges. And that means acknowledging that over the last decade, we've had rising distrust within almost all of our societies of democratic institutions and elected officials, and corruption and division that authoritarian challengers are exploiting. And we also have to recognize that we have democratic backsliding within the ranks of our own institutions, NATO first and foremost being one of them. And we have to look to take steps that focuses on reversing some of this democratic backsliding that we're having within our own ranks, in the United States as well, and thinking about some of the incentives and costs that we can implement within our own member states and these institutions to push back against this democratic decline. And I think that's where you don't see kind of the other side of the ideological spectrum focusing. The other side of the ideological spectrum, conservatives, more hawkish foreign policy types, acknowledge the great power competition, acknowledges the challenges from Russia and China, but do not acknowledge that there are steps we have to take to strengthen our own system within the transatlantic community alongside that.
Yeah, I would totally agree with what Tori said, and maybe just add a couple. I think trade is one of those issues where it's not necessarily, we're not going to sort of just pick up TTIP and then try to run with that again. I think there needs to be, in some ways, a rethinking of our economic relations. But in an era where, you know, with the, you know, we're all concerned both on both sides of the Atlantic about China, about the broader global trading arrangement, it makes sense for the U.S. and Europe to be converging economically, not diverging. And so I think one of the first steps should be to de-escalate and, if not end, the current trade tension, and then establish a longer-term engagement with the EU, negotiation, if you want to put it that way, not just over trade, but over regulatory harmonization, areas where we can just, because there are, tariffs aren't that high anymore. And so what we're really talking about is how we can get our economies to be more integrated. So there's more cultural exchanges, more that we're trading and operating more closely together. And the other area I would just say is defense. I think that this is one where a new administration, I think for me, should come in and just say, we're not opposed to EU defense. And in fact, you know, we're supportive of these efforts, and we're going to, with the United States, as we've been sort of, you know, blocking and trying to oppose every single small PESCO initiative, no, that's fine. Go forth. And, you know, we hope, and in fact, I think we would want to encourage the EU to continue to develop that defense capability. So I think an initial signal from a new administration saying we back these efforts, I think would also would go a long way.
You know, I want to take us back just to the millennial study, if you will, or progressive foreign policy. First of all, I thought that was such a great thing, because I cannot tell you how bored I am with with all that's being said and thought about in terms of new directions for U.S. foreign policy and blah, blah, blah. God, it's just awful stuff. And it's stuff coming out of people out of my generation, so pox on them, and they can fight me in the street when they see me. But I think it's been boring and horrible stuff, the think tank world strangling itself on this crap. So I was very happy to see a progressive foreign policy just to get some new ideas and new thinking. So my question for you both is, how was it received when you went out there and you published this thing and you're talking about a millennial, well, not a millennial, but a progressive approach, you know, Rachel, a good friend and colleague standing on her soapbox talking about NATO. How was all of that received? Did you get brickbats from people, or did people like me come on and say, gosh, it's great to have some new ideas?
And Max, maybe we can start with you, because before we started recording, you were talking about some of the feedback that you just were receiving on your when you were just in Brussels last week. So it would be fantastic to hear not just on the progressive approach to transatlantic relations, but your larger report, which again put the EU front and center. And it sounds like there was some kind of skepticism even on the side of the Europeans.
So the thing that I've been shocked at is the lack of skepticism actually here in Washington. And maybe it's those people just aren't expressing those views. But I think I was expecting to get a lot of blowback, people sort of picking arguments on Twitter saying, this is incredibly, you know, this is naive, the EU is feckless, what are you talking about? And that hasn't really happened. And in fact, I think the reception in Washington has been, you sort of outlined, Jim, has been very positive, so that this is sort of the new thinking we need. We need to sort of, Europe matters now again, and we need to rethink how we were going about, how we were approaching it. So I think the reaction has been actually far more positive than I expected. I think in Europe, it's somewhat depends on the country. And the reaction in France to this has been very positive. UK a little bit less. But then, you know, in Brussels, obviously they've, you know, this is great, you're focused on us. But there's been this, as we talked about before we came on, a tinge of doubt, a tinge of, well, you know, we've tried to, from EU folks that, and I was just in Brussels on Friday, and this is some of what I felt, that, well, we've tried to do this in the past. We've tried to engage you. We wanted to bring, you know, such and such delegation that I'm sure people on our side literally had no idea who any of these people were. And, you know, the response from the Americans was just, And so a sense of Europe has tried to reach out again and again and again and has constantly gotten the cold shoulder. That being said, I do feel like if there was a new Democratic administration, if there was that was pursuing this approach, I think you would see immense enthusiasm. And I think it's very easy to address that skepticism. And addressing that skepticism, it just requires clearly outlining it from the top down in a new administration, from a presidential statement or other signals. So.
And Tori, any feedback on kind of the reception you have heard?
I think primarily there have been three types of feedback, not just to this piece, but to these types of arguments, progressive foreign policy arguments related to Europe. The first is positive. So it's, I think people, from what I've heard, it's refreshing to hear new ideas, different approaches being put on the table, particularly in 2020. I mean, this is the year we have to be thinking about how we're going to advance this relationship under a new administration or in a second Trump administration. I mean, either way, as we were talking about earlier in the podcast, there are aspects of this relationship that have fallen into disrepair that need to be readdressed, particularly given shifting global power dynamics. And so one positive has been, okay, this is refreshing and we need new ideas on the table. The second two pieces of feedback have been these tinges of doubt that Max mentioned. On the one hand, there is the kind of knee-jerk security reaction that if we're putting forward a U.S. approach that supports European strategic autonomy, that supports initiatives such as PESCO or the European Defense Fund, that we are arguing that NATO is a little bit less relevant, a little bit less of a priority within the transatlantic space. I think that this is a narrative that will slowly shift over time, but that is one, I think, lingering doubt to these types of arguments. And the second is, and this is, Max has addressed this a lot, we need to be putting forward Brussels and the European Union and European institutions and actors as a key geopolitical partner for the United States. And I think the initial response to all of that is, Brussels? Are you sure? This has been a capital that has long been riddled with bureaucratic inefficiencies. And if you need to get something done, you go to Berlin, you go to Paris, you go to London, and that's how you advance a transatlantic agenda within the U.S. and Europe. And I think it's going to take a narrative shift to try to paint Europe, particularly under the von der Leyen Commission, as a potential geopolitical actor for the United States to work with.
Well, you know, this has been brought back so many memories of wrestling with trying to get Washington interested in the EU. I mean, the point about the EU, Europeans saying, you know, we've tried, we've reached out, and they're continuing to do the same thing. They'll bring delegations over and they'll come see us, and I'll say, well, who are you seeing in the administration? Well, and they'll mention an action officer or whatever, and it's like, God, you know, you're not seeing anyone. But I have to say, during the Obama administration, during Clinton administration, they wouldn't see them either.
Yeah, this is bipartisan in some ways, that the past response
is
not simply.
Ignorance is bipartisan. And, you know, I'll never forget being at the Chicago NATO summit and sitting a row or two behind the president, and he was reading a magazine instead of listening to the discussion. I was probably doing the same thing, but anyway, so it's just the way it is. And I guess that's part of this, too. This is the nature of the beast. No matter who is elected, no matter who's brought in, no matter how much it makes a lot of sense for us to, you know, to have different approaches with Europe and to do things with Europe, we're still going to have this kind of maybe it won't be as much the dismissive mocking that we've had post-Cold War, but it'll still be this ignorance and it'll still be this Europe question mark, and we just have to get used to it and just deal with it. And that's the thing. You just have to deal with it.
Yeah, but I think, you know, we'll wrap up here. We're kind of long on time, but just to say that, Tori, both you and Max are doing such fantastic work. It is refreshing to see these new ideas on the table. Feels like it's breathed some new life, a little bit of momentum here in Washington. It does feel like there at least is some momentum in people understanding that, given all of the dynamics that you've both laid out, but competition with Russia and China in particular, that Europe is going to be critical. And I think you guys have both done a tremendous amount to push the ball forward and kind of rally the community. So we look forward to a lot of seeing more of your work here in the future. So thank you both.
No, yeah. Thank you so much.
It's been great to both listen to you all and to read your pieces. And you know what's interesting? I was just thinking, we're seeing the same template with the European Union right now, where at the beginning of administration, it's like, oh my God, they're the enemy. And now we're starting to see this thing, well, we do need to work with Europe, et cetera, et cetera. So we're seeing history repeat itself. But thank you so much again.
Thanks for
all
the great conversation,
too.
No, really appreciate it. Thanks for having us.